As we continue to worship the Lord through the reading of his word, it's Esther chapter 2, starting in verse 1. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's servants who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan the citadel, into the women's quarters, under the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This thing pleased the king, and he did so. In Shushan the citadel there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is, Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it was when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan the citadel under the custody of Hegai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace into the care of Hegai, the custodian of the women. Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor. So he readily gave beauty preparations to her besides her allowance. Then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. And every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. Please be seated. As we continue to look at the chronological history of Israel, we are in the into the prophets. We're well past where what's called post-exilic. Actually, they've been sent out back into Babylon into Jerusalem. They've been there for, I don't know, probably close to 40 years by now. The temple is built. At this point, the walls are still not built. That's going to come a little later in Nehemiah. And so we come along chronologically in this book of Esther. It's the last of the historical books as you look at the canon of Scripture as it goes through its history and then its poetry and then its prophecy in the Old Testament. And this is the last of the historical books of the Bible. And there are a couple of other things that are fascinating about this, and one of them we're going to be talking about quite a bit today, is there's no mention of the name of God in Esther at all. Neither is there mention of prayer. There's a mention of fasting, which implies prayer a little later on in the book, but there's no mention of prayer. Now, the prevailing thought is that this book is about God's sovereignty, his supreme power, his supreme authority over mankind, and his providence, which is that divine power that sustains and guides human destiny. It's more than just provision, you know, Lord. You know, we pray, Lord, that you might provide for us, you know, in our daily needs. It's more than that. It's actually the moving forward of humanity's destiny to its ultimate, I'm not going to say end, its ultimate transition into eternity. And I find that very, very important as we look at today, as we see, you know, as we read the newspapers and we see these nations coming against nations, wars, rumors of wars, and, you know, especially as we see what's going on in to the north of Israel. And so this is wonderful to come back to and to reflect on, that whether God may or may not be mentioned, whether God may or may not be obvious in the situation, especially since we're dealing with godless people who are making these decisions, he's still very much involved. He's still very much moving things along, and that's his divine providence. And so we're kind of, if you will, in an Esther-like time in our own lives as we read the newspaper and we see what's going on. So out of free will, Once the Medo-Persian Empire took over Babylon, out of free will, one of the first things that Cyrus did is he released the Jews to go back to Jerusalem. 50,000 made the trip, just a little less than that. Several years later, 2,000 more made the trip with Ezra the scribe. Though everybody was called, it wasn't just those 52,000, everyone was called to go back. Those were the only ones that responded. Out of roughly somewhere between 1.5 and 3 million, there's a lot of swing, obviously. The estimation is the number of people there that were Jews. There were roughly that many that came from Israel into Babylon several hundred years before. Maybe it's because they'd become comfortable. Maybe it's because they'd become successful. You know, the Lord told them in Jeremiah, whenever you go into captivity, bloom where you're planted, man. Do what is necessary to make a life, because you're going to be there for 70 years. Well, these folks had been there long, you know, long past 70 years. We just read a brief lineage of one of our main characters, Mordecai, and he's, what, fourth, fifth generation. So, you know, they're having kids, and, you know, all of a sudden Mordecai and Sons has a nice little shop up here, and why would I leave this and go back to that desolate land? But instead of giving up the 4 months that it would take to travel to Jerusalem and engaging in the work that God had for them there, what we're going to find out later is that they're going to live an entire year with the threat of death hanging over them. Which would you choose? So, again, we come back to the fact that sometimes God is hidden, but he's always present. And his sovereignty is always in effect. You know, and what we saw in last week's chapter when Ahasuerus, or Xerxes is what he's also known as, and Vashti had this argument because he made a demand on her that she wasn't comfortable with, and he being just an absolute flake, just a nutcase, you know, he makes this horrible demand of her. She says no, and so he puts her away. And God used this in his providence in saving the Jews from execution, mass execution, because it was necessary that the Jews stay intact throughout the entirety of this time, because where's the promised Messiah coming from? The Jews. And so he is obligated to keep that that people intact. And so it continues this plan. So at this point in time, historically, the Persian Empire was the largest the world had ever seen. It had eclipsed Babylon, certainly. 127 provinces covered today what we call everything from India to Egypt, parts of Egypt, including Israel, Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Pakistan, Jordan, Lebanon, Sudan, Libya, Arabia, and in North Africa. Approximately 50 million people in this territory, the largest empire the world had ever seen. Also at this time, again, remember Ezra the scribe had returned to Jerusalem. And so as you look chronologically, as you're reading through the book of Ezra, when you hit chapter 6, then you can kind of insert Esther right there before you get to chapter 7, because that's what happens. And it's about a 10-year period. Like I said before, the temple had been rebuilt about 30 years before. So we're dealing with this hothead, foolish king, a guy by the name of Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, as it reads here in the text. Haman, who we're going to be introduced here shortly, just a wicked man in the king's court. Mordecai, he's a decent, but he's a calculating man. And then Esther, an orphan who all of a sudden rises to prominence. So it opens up in verse 1 of chapter 2, after these things. Well, after what things? Well, verse 16 indicates that there's this four-year span between chapters 1 and chapter 2, and these things are that time when, during that time when Xerxes made this unreasonable demand and put Vashti away, and then he went off. He went off to fight Greece, and he lost miserably at Thermopylae. If you remember, if you've ever seen that movie 300, that's that period of time. And that 300 refers to the Spartans that actually held off Xerxes, and I think I didn't see the movie because I it's rated R. But I, my understanding is that, that Xerxes was depicted as somebody very tall, very very bald, and just a real big brutal guy, and just kind of, and I think they captured his personality a little bit as being a bit of a nutcase. So that's where that's about. But anyway, so he goes to Thermopylae. He gets he comes home a defeated man. It's going to be another 100 years or so until the Medo-Persian Empire falls. Alexander the Great is going to come in, and he's going to cause that to fall, as well as some internal problems. But it's important to know that what we're seeing here, if you remember Nebuchadnezzar's vision in Daniel chapter 2 that Daniel interprets, Nebuchadnezzar is the head of gold, the Medo-Persian Empire is the chest and arms of silver, and we're beginning to transition into the torso and the hips of bronze, which is the Greek Empire. So we're starting to see that transition. It's going to be about 100 years, like I said. But anyway, he comes back after 4 years. He comes back and he kind of goes, wait a minute, I don't have a queen. I got a problem. But he couldn't change the law that he made. The law specifically stated that whenever a Persian king made a law, he could not go back and change it. So he couldn't bring Vashti back, but he had no queen. So his court looking around saying, hey, you know what? The king's kind of depressed. He needs a wife. He needs a queen. So we need to do something about this. And so they suggested, why don't you let all of the beautiful young virgins be sought out and brought into the court. That's what the citadel is the palace or the court. Bring them in, and you can choose a woman from amongst them to be the queen. Now, you would think that that's not a bad thing. But this is not a beauty contest. All but the chosen woman would be a perpetual widow because they would be put into a harem, if you will. They would become a concubine. They would not be married to the king, but they would be completely unable to resume their former life or ever get married. So it was kind of a soft prison, if you will. I mean, they were living well, but that's all they had. As a matter of fact, you'll read later on that they had guards posted in the harem. That wasn't to keep people from getting in. That was to keep them from killing each other. 400 women vying for attention of the king. So it says here that, you know, in verse 5 that there's a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, cousin of Esther, came to Babylon in one of the first, probably the second wave of relocation. Eventually, it looks like they made their way to Persia because it says he is in the citadel. He hears what's going on. So he's got some position in the court of the king. It's never made entirely clear. And it says that he brought up Hadassah, that is Esther. Esther's Jewish name, Hadassah, means myrtle. And the Persian name, Esther, means star. So she was raised by her cousin Mordecai since the death of her father and mother. Interestingly enough, her Hebrew name or Jewish name, Hadassah, myrtle, that's what the Lord uses as a symbolic purification of Israel, that the thorn bushes, the briars, would be replaced by myrtle. Her Persian name, Esther, is a derivative of Ashtoreth or Isitar, which is the Babylonian goddess. Mordecai's name, on the other hand, in case you're interested, is a Babylonian name after the Babylonian god Marduk. So you have Marduk and Ishtar that are coming into the kingdom, just further removing them, the whole thing, from, you know, having the Lord's name in it. But again, they were part of this Jewish community that decided not to return. They'd had a couple of chances to go, and they decided not to go. Judah's a kind of a backwards and a wild place. We've got it pretty comfortable here, especially if Mordecai's in the court of the king. So Esther, it says, is taken to the king's palace. It doesn't seem like Esther has a whole lot of say in this, that she's, I don't know if she's encouraged or if she just kind of grabbed by the arm and said, let's go. This is an opportunity. And there were approximately 400 women at this point that had come together for this choosing, if you will. And it says here that the that she was both. Let me see here. How does she put it? That the young woman was lovely and beautiful. What that speaks to is not only the physical beauty, but also there was a spirit about her. She was a lovely woman. We've seen, if I may, and I don't mean to be sexist about this at all, but we've seen, we can think of women who are what you would call handsome, possibly, or fair looking. But there's a beauty about them. They're lovely women, which completely surpasses their physical beauty. And that's what they're saying about Esther. So she is just a joy to be around, and she's also a joy to look at, is basically what it comes down to. And so she catches the attention of some folks, and specifically the guy who's in charge. He's a eunuch, and he's in charge of the women. And so he's got authority over this, and she begins to draw his attention, not specifically because of anything that she's done, but because of who she is. Proverbs 3:3-4 says, "Let not mercy and truth forsake you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart, and so find favor and high esteem in the sight of God and man." And that kind of describes Esther's attitude. So it was, you could say it was a godly attitude, a loveliness about her that caught their attention. So he begins to pay more attention, give her more beauty preparations than what everybody else was getting, and he gives her his favor, and he tells her the things to do. And so he really is transforming this woman. He gives her 7 choice maidservants to look after her beauty needs. But there's one thing she's not revealing, and that's that she's Jewish. And I think that's probably the main point that we want to pull out of this chapter. I can't think of a good reason ever for hiding the fact that we're Christians, that we belong to God. Now, we may not necessarily, it may not necessarily be in situations to be presenting the gospel. For instance, you're in a business situation, and what your obligation is to communicate that which you're being paid to communicate. But everything that you say needs to be honoring to God. Everything that you say needs to be an issue of integrity and an issue of character, because what you're doing ultimately when you step out of what it is that you're doing is there needs to be an identification that I do what I do because he did what he did, and I belong to him. And so there is absolutely no circumstance, no reason for hiding the fact that we're Christians. We don't need to wear it on our chest, but we can never find a reason for hiding it. And a lot of us act sometimes as if we're secret agents, that we're going to kind of sneak into somebody's life and all of a sudden go, "I'm a Christian." And that's why I act the way that I do, and I was just hoping to draw you in. No. Jesus told us in Matthew 10, "Therefore, whoever confesses me before men, him I will also confess before my Father who is in heaven. Whoever denies me before men, him I will also deny before my Father who is in heaven." We can't live a life of denial and expect God to recognize us. I loved what Danny Victoria sung this morning, and I swear I think he steals my notes when he's putting together the songs. Because that's exactly right. I'm not ashamed of the Father. I'm not ashamed of the Son. I'm not ashamed of the Holy Spirit. And that's the way that we have to live our lives. So Mordecai, though, charged her not to reveal it. And apparently he sensed that was the right thing to do in the circumstance, and Esther agreed. And I don't see that Mordecai's a godless man. I don't see that Esther's necessarily a godless woman. But they're saying, you know, we need to play this right. We need to play it right. As we look through the book of Daniel, we saw that that's exactly the opposite of what he did when he was threatened by this same situation where the Persian king, you know, issues a decree that can't be removed. And they say, you know, anybody that prays to anybody but Darius for, you know, for the next 30 days, they get thrown into a lion's den. And so what's Daniel do? He goes about his day. He does exactly what he's always going to do, which is to pray to his God, not to his king. So we are in a situation today where it is going to really cost us something to identify ourselves with Christ. There's no doubt in my mind that should the Lord tarry and we continue on the next 10, 20 years, that it is going to cost those folks who identify themselves with Jesus Christ. The church itself today is under pressure to identify itself less and less with Jesus Christ, and unfortunately, in so many cases, they're failing miserably. They're caving into that kind of pressure. And because I identify myself with Jesus Christ, I identify myself with the doctrine that he put forth, and therefore these things are what my life is about, and these things will never be what my life is about. And the world hates that. It's going to cost us something. What the book of Esther teaches us is that even though they were not willing to associate themselves with God publicly, they were still participants in his will. They were still very much involved with God's providence, moving things forward. And it also teaches us that the Lord is working apart from us, in spite of us, or through us. Now, which is it that we want to be a part of? Do you want the Lord to be working apart from you, in spite of you, because you're coming up against him, or through you? His will is sovereign, and his word, once sent out from him, will not return to him void, but it's going to accomplish exactly what it was set out to do. So where are you in his word and what's going on? So the question that we have to ask ourselves is what part we want to have in God's will? Whether that's in the daily part of our lives, you know, Lord, where do you want me to work? I want to work where you want me to work, no matter where it is. I want to live where you want me to live. I want to have exactly the number of children and grandchildren that you want me to have. I want to have the spouse that you want me to have. I want to do everything to your glory. I want to do everything according to your will. So that's the daily, and that's where we live. But it could also be the divine appointments he's set up. Lord, not only do I want to be what you want me to be, but I want to be where you want me to be. I want to do what you want me to do. And so I'm just totally willing, I'm totally open, and I'm looking for those opportunities where God says, I want you to move into this situation, whether it's on a bus, in a cafeteria, across the street. This is where I want you to be, because I've got something for you. I've got something for you to do. You may not see the fruit of it, but I have. Or I'm just ready to knock your socks off with what's going to happen. So the question is that we have to ask ourselves is what part we want to have in God's will, whether that's in the daily of our lives or the divine appointments he's set up. How wonderful. What an incredible privilege to be part of his plan for the saving of souls, for showing mercy, for the love of Jesus, for showing the love of Jesus. And we get to be a part of that. The Lord's going to do it in spite of us. He's going to do it through us. He's going to do it apart from us. So the question remains, what part do I want to play, Lord, in your almighty and good plans? Where do I want to be in your will? I want to be dead in the middle of it. And your life could be humming along just fine, and you still not be in God's will. Mordecai seemed to be doing okay for himself, but was he necessarily in God's will? The fact that he had encouraged Esther to be a part of this, and it's going to turn out great for everybody. Does that necessarily mean that that was God's will? No, it does not. He simply used the circumstances that was presented because of the way that they lived their lives, and he said, this is how I'm going to do it. That's why his name is never mentioned. So it says, every day while Esther is in there, he's pacing back and forth in front of the king, the women's quarters. You know, he wants to know what's going on. He's got a love for this young lady. He raised her up, you know, as his own. He's got a great love for her. And then in verse 12, it says, each young woman's turn came to go into King Ahasuerus after she had completed 12 months preparation, according to the regulations for the women. For thus were the days of their preparation apportioned, 6 months with oil of myrrh, 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying women. Thus prepared, each young woman went to the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the women's quarters to the king's palace. So basically they could dress themselves and beautify themselves and just embellish themselves in any way they'd like. In the evening she went, being Esther, and in the morning, in the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women, to the custody of Shazgaz, the king's eunuch who kept the concubines. She would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. 12-month spa. Sound pretty good? It's been said that, Persia was one of the many countries famous for its aromatic perfumes, you know, for the preparation of brides, you know, ritualistic baths, the plucking of the eyebrows, the painting of the hands and the feet, and you know, special makeup, and this, you know, the beauty oils and paste and stuff all over the body, and you know, so the stuff that we're looking at in our society is not new. I mean, this is something that they've been doing for millennia. And it's been said that one of the reasons for the lengthy time of preparation was, number one, to help the women came into the court pregnant, because the king didn't want to be accused of fathering a child that wasn't his, even though they were all supposed to be virgins. And then secondly, it was because a lot of these women, though beautiful, were out in the desert. You know, the king doesn't want to touch leathery skin. The king doesn't want to see blemishes. The king wants beauty and perfection. And so a whole year to prepare these women for this date with the king. Guys, as much as I hate to say this, maybe we shouldn't complain so much when our wives are late. It ain't that bad, I guess. A whole year. So, again, it sounds wonderful. A year of constant spa treatments, being pampered. Yet it all came down to one night. One evening with the king. If he chose them from the 400 others to be his queen, then she would be his companion. Until, of course, she displeased him. The 399 who lost, they were in a harem where they stayed his concubine. Rarely, if ever, did they see him afterwards. Never free to marry another man. Never free to resume their old life. They were essentially living as a perpetual widow. Is that such so great a life? Now you understand that why there were guards in the harem. You know, idleness has a tendency to do that kind of thing. So verse 15, now when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter to go into the king, she requested nothing but what he gave the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. Remember, not only because she is beautiful, because she's a lovely person. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the other virgins. And, You can read that that King loved Esther. I don't know that that's necessarily the kind of love that we associate with. It's more kind of, wow, she's the one. I don't know that there was any love there at all, because it was all about Ahasuerus. It wasn't about his bride. So he loved Esther more than all the other women. So he set the royal crown upon her head, made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants. This guy really loved to party. And he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of the king. So she was smart. She could take anything that she wants into it. You know, she can embellish herself any way that she wants to do it, you know, trying to draw attention, the attention of the king. And she looks to the eunuch and says, what should I do? And he says, here you go. This is what you need to do. So she's smart. And it says she obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. Again, loveliness. But here's the thing. It's beauty that often gains people, especially women. It's beauty that gains people's favors with others. It's a part of human nature. That's something that we have to accept, even as Christians. And in doing so, we need to teach our children, we need to teach our youth, we need to teach our grandchildren what really matters. And that we cannot rely upon beauty for our judgment of people, because some of those beautiful people in the world are some of the most wicked and absurd. Nor can we rely on outward beauty to accomplish what we want. I know for most of the men in here, that's not an issue. But for the women, we can't rely on outward beauty to judge people. And we have a tendency to do that. All sociological studies have a tendency to do that. Pretty people get paid better. Pretty people get more options. Pretty people have doors opened up to them that plain people typically don't have access to. So what we have to understand is that we cannot rely upon beauty to judge what somebody's character is, nor can we rely upon our own beauty to accomplish what we want, should we be so blessed with physical beauty. Instead, we're all to cultivate Christ-like quality and demand the same thing of those of whom we desire those relationships. We need to require Christ-like quality in our relationships, and we need to cultivate Christ-like quality. So even if you are not beautiful, you could still be considered lovely. Proverbs 31:30, charm is deceitful and beauty is passing, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. 1 Peter 3:3-4, do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. It's been said that what you win them with is what you win them to. So if what's drawing folks to you is your outward beauty, it doesn't run very deep. The relationship doesn't run very deep. I find it intriguing that I think it's Fox News. If you go onto their website, they'll very often run these slideshows where they're capturing celebrities without makeup. And that's a big deal, because we like to, you know, we like to see the beautiful people, not so beautiful. We need to cultivate an inner beauty, and that goes for the men as well as the women. Now, it doesn't say don't arrange the hair, don't wear gold, don't put on fine apparel. It says don't let your adornment be merely outward. As J. Vernon McGee used to say, if the bar needs painting, then paint it. So, you know, this is not an objection to those things. The question is, what is it you're spending your time cultivating? Is it the quietness of your heart, or is it the softness of your skin? Esther's life has so far been amazing. She was a child of Jewish exiles, both died, raised by her cousin in a foreign, hostile land, taken by the compulsion into the king's harem, finds favor with all whom she meets, which again speaks to her character, and she is finally selected to be the queen of the realm. This wasn't an accident, nor was it merely because of her beauty and because of her loveliness. God has a plan. Esther is part of it. Psalm 75, 6 and 7 says, "For exaltation comes neither from the east nor the west, nor from the south, but God is the judge. He puts down one and exalts another." And in exactly that same way, we have a place in God's plan. Wherever you are right now, God has a purpose for it. Wherever you are right now, God has a purpose for it. Maybe for a short time. Maybe for a long time. It may be for something big. We know from Zerubbabel that God doesn't have small things. There are no small things in God's plan. But it may be for a small purpose at the moment. God has a reason. You know, he uses the evil of men to work out his plan. You know, if you think about it, God did not make Ahasuerus drunk. He didn't make him demand that his queen present herself, you know, in this way that she objected to for whatever reason. You know, but yet he allowed this wicked action of this man to fulfill a purpose in his greater plan. He did not cause Vashti to refuse. And if you think about it, just in a generation past from ours, if you consider Hitler, the wickedness of an entire country and the wickedness of a man who was able to turn the hearts of these people towards an entire race of people, the Jews, and yet it was that thing that won the sympathy of the entire world that allowed Israel to come back together in 1948 after, you know, I mean, gosh, they've been trying to get this done since the turn of the 20th century. You know, the Balfour Declaration that, you know, Israel should at some point become a state in the land of Palestine, and that was, like I said, that was at the turn of the 20th century, and all of a sudden in May of 1948, all of a sudden it is a country because of what God did and what he used was the wickedness of an entire nation, of a man who hated Jews. Consider the international wranglings with Syria now, bringing Russia and Iran toe-to-toe with the U.S. and Israel, and they're fighting over Damascus that Isaiah 17 says will cease to become a city, or it will cease to be a city. Think about these things. God will use the wickedness of men. His will is going to march forward in spite of or through or apart from what people do. Psalm 2, I just love Psalm 2 where it says, well, you don't have to turn there. I take just great comfort in this. It says, "Why do the nations rage and the people plot a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together," so they're all coming together, "against the Lord, against his anointed Jesus, saying, 'Let us break their bonds in pieces, cast away their cords from us.'" And what's the Lord's response? "He who sits in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall hold them in derision." Dear Vlad, God's got your number. We know who wins. We know who wins. Now, there's a lot of lies that are caught up in this, and we need to pray for that. We need to pray for the suffering of those people who are caught up in this. But we know who wins. We find assurance in the truth that no other person, no matter how evil they are, can defeat God's plan. Nor can they defeat God's plan for your life. No matter what they've done to you or what they will do to you, they cannot defeat God's plan in your life. If you hold tight. Verse 19, when the virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Now Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up to him. So he's sitting in the king's gate. He's got some association with the decision makers. They're men of influence in the kingdom. That may be why he is hiding his own heritage, because maybe he doesn't have that kind of, he would not have that kind of association if they knew that he was a Jew. And this book has been criticized because it does not mention the name of God. It's often been criticized as, you know, why is this in the canon of Scripture? It doesn't mention the name of God. Here's some interesting things to think about. One of them is, you know, if you're into this kind of detail, the name Yahweh is hidden in acrostics based on the initial and final letters of successive words in Esther 1:20, 5:4, 5:13, and 7:7. And in some manuscripts, you can actually see the letters of these words are written a bit larger to give them prominence. So God's word is hidden in code in the book of Esther, you know, if that's something that appeals to you. It could also be that God's name does not appear here because it was written under Persian rule for distribution in the Persian Empire. Remember, this was a part of the Persian record. I think that the reason why it was put into canon, in the canon of Scripture, and why it's brought forward to us is because it shows how God works behind the scenes. He's always active. He's always moving his will forward. Verse 21, in those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther. Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed. And both were hanged on a gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. So this is going to be incredibly important later on in the story. We're not going to get to it today. So Mordecai, he overhears this. He tells Esther. Esther informs the king. You know, Mordecai's doing the right thing. He's not thinking in terms of, hey, it would be a great thing for the king to die. Wouldn't be bad at all. You know, he does the right thing. And so, you know, and this threat of assassination is real. As a matter of fact, that's eventually how Ahasuerus is going to die, or Xerxes is going to die. He's murdered by his prime minister, and who placed his son, Artaxerxes I, on the throne. So these guys are hanged on a gallows. By the way, that's not, don't think cowboy hanging from a tree stuff. This is a tree which they impale them on, which was kind of the next thing that that they brought forward was a crucifixion. Chapter 3, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him in his seat above all the princes who were with him. So he's this wicked, wicked, ungodly man, but God has a purpose for him. He allows him to be promoted. And this guy is a descendant of Agag, who is the king of the Amalekites. If you remember your history in Exodus, these were Israel's sworn enemy. Saul, in Kings, was commanded to kill all the Amalekites, including King Agag, and wipe out all of the livestock and everything. So Samuel comes to him and he says, did you do exactly what God had called you to do? And he said, yep, wiped them all out, done. So what's this sheep that I'm hearing in my ear? Well, I saved the best for God. And then he discovers that he has spared the life of King Agag. And so now, all these years later, the descendants of Agag, because Saul did not do as he was called to do, he did not wipe out Agag or his family, and now all of a sudden we have a descendant threatening again to kill the Jews. It'll happen again in Jesus' time when Herod sits on the throne as he tries to destroy the innocents. When the Lord directs us to do something, he isn't going to necessarily tell us that our disobedience is going to affect future generations. But it could affect future generations. When the Lord tells us to do something, gosh, why don't we just submit to that? Why don't we just do that? And all the king's servants who were with the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were within the gates, king's gates, said to Mordecai, why do you transgress the king's command? There's not a biblical command to bowing or paying homage to anybody, to a political leader, as a sign of respect, but there's something possibly that Mordecai knows about Haman. I'm just speculating here, but maybe it's because he knows that he's an Agagite, and I'm not going to bow to that man. But something has persuaded Mordecai that Haman is unworthy of that honor. And so, you know, the folks that he's hanging out with said, why, man, why are you doing that? Why are you risking this by going against the king's word? In verse 4, it says, now it happened when they spoke to him daily and he would not listen to them, that they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. For Mordecai had told them he was a Jew. So he's now beginning to open up. He's telling these folks around him. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. He was going to make an example. Haman doesn't notice that Mordecai is not doing this until it's pointed out to him by his aides. And he's furious. Those kind of things come from pride and insecurity. You know, maybe you've met somebody like that, where they are just incredibly successful, just amazing. People love them, they're doing well. And there's this one person that just really gets their goat. And they can't, and they will obsess about this person because there's that one person that withholds their appreciation for this individual. And that's the way Haman was. He can't stand the thought that this one, I mean, he's got the entirety of this empire under his feet. He's got all the wealth he could possibly need, and there's this one guy. And it throws him into such a rage that he's just not going to take care of this guy, but he's going to take care of everybody of the same race, of the same people. So it exposes his basic hatred for all Jewish people. And maybe that's still, you know, left over from the fact that he is an Agagite. So in the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, which is the lot, before Haman to determine the day of the month, and it fell on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. So this is the Pur is the Persian word for the lot or dice, something like dice. You know, they're rolling to see what's going to happen. You know, they're kind of throwing these before their gods and letting the gods, you know, take care of this for them. But it was the God, the Lord, that took care of things. And they're in the first month when they do this, and the Lord makes sure that whatever it is that they're rolling, whatever it is they're casting, shows them that they're going to do it in the last month of the year. So there's an entire year for the Lord to work through the things that he wants to do. In Proverbs 16, it says, the lot is cast into the lap, but every decision is from the Lord. So the Lord is still in this, and he's controlling all the circumstances. Verse 8, then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, is a certain people scattered and dispersed amongst all the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all the other peoples. They do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written, remember, and can't be changed, that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasuries. Do you know, King, that there's people that have laws different from yours? The king had thought about it for a moment. Yeah, but it's been since my great-great-grandfather. They've done fine here. As a matter of fact, they've been a real contribution to the society. I mean, what is it they're doing that's so bad? But no, that's not what he said. He goes, yeah, that's a great idea. I think that we should purge everybody who doesn't think like we think. So it says, let a decree be written that they be destroyed. So he's organizing the mass murder of the Jewish people. And he says, man, I'll pay into the treasury to get this done. That's a lot of money. So and I think what happens was he was thinking that because this is also involved pillaging, that he would get his money back in, you know, tenfold as they captured the Jewish property. So verse 10, so the king took a signet ring from his hand, gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, the money and the people are given to you to do them as seems good to you. And so I don't think Xerxes had any idea what he agreed to. He probably believed that he was merely agreeing to the execution of a handful of folks in the kingdom, you know, not wiping out an entire race. Verse 12, then the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month, and a decree was written according to all that Haman commanded, to the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each province, to the officials of all people, to every province according to its script, and to every people in the language. In the name of King Ahasuerus it was written, and sealed with the king's signet ring. And the letters were sent by couriers into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, again a year later, which is the month of Adar, to plunder their possessions. A copy of the document was to be issued as a law in every province, being published for all people, that they should be ready for that day. The couriers went out, by the way, that's where we got our Pony Express from, is this very thing. The couriers went out, hastened by the king's command, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan the citadel. So the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. A death sentence throughout the entire empire. The only difference between this and all the other attacks on the Jews throughout history is that this one was announced. We've seen this happen over and over and over again. So the king sat down with Haman to drink, and he thought he'd done well. I really don't think he understood, and we'll see when we get into the banquet that Esther holds, that he finally understands what it is that he's done. But he thinks he's done a good job. But Shushan is looking around going, wait a minute. That's the bakery of the man. That man owns the bakery that I go to. Or that's the person that makes my clothes. And gosh, we've been friends, and our kids are friends. Why would the king do this? And if we look at that, we kind of get an understanding of what was happening in Europe pre-World War II. That's kind of what we see even today in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict before it just really exploded. That's what we're seeing in Europe today, again, as anti-Semitism is on the rise. Wait a minute, these are my neighbors. Why would somebody declare war, desire to wipe them out? Because they knew them. They had played in their kids had played in the street together. Maybe they'd even been over to each other's houses, been set on neighborhood boards together. So Shushan was perplexed. All this came to pass because of the insecurity and wounded pride of one wicked man. So how do we take this home? There's a couple of smaller lessons here, if you will, that I think that we can take home. The first one we just read about regarding prejudice based upon our encounter with any other person of another creed or race or faith or nationality. We're all subject to sin. We're all in need of a Savior. We share the same basic needs of salvation, of food, of shelter, and of love. And so there's not a single person on this earth that can offend us so badly that we could look to the entirety of a race or look to the entirety of a creed or a nationality and say that I hold all of them responsible for this thing. Now, that also, not only does that apply to us because we are to not have prejudice for any, but a love for all. And certainly for all those who are in the body of Christ, because, you know, it says pretty clearly that there's neither Jew nor Greek nor woman nor man, that we're all the same in the love of Christ. But for those who are not believers, aren't they merely those who could one day be in the body of Christ? We have no right to have any prejudice against anyone, including those who are caught in sin, in sinful lifestyles. We cannot prejudge somebody or prejudge an entirety of persons based upon the actions of one. So we are not to prejudge, which is what prejudice means, but we're to love all, not accept all. We're certainly not going to accept those that are caught in sinful lifestyles. We're not going to accept their sin, but we're going to love them, hopefully love them right into the kingdom. So we have to be careful not to judge. And by the same token, we are to be such that we don't cause somebody else to judge all of Christianity by our actions. Now, we can't direct somebody's heart. And if they're prone to rejecting Christianity or prone to rejecting God because they want to embrace their sin, we can't control that. But what we can control is making sure that we don't stumble somebody because we're being such ingracious or unkind or unchristlike people. So that's one lesson. Another lesson is, of course, has to do with physical beauty and in its place in our lives, and to instead to cultivate those things, with those inner beauty, which is going to last well past when the wrinkles start. You know, I used to be beautiful a long time ago. That's what my mom called me when I was about that big. Never since. But the greatest takeaway is that God continues to